We're talking in her office in North Hall, and the date is July 6, 1981. This is the beginning of the second tape of the interview.
Was it?
Okay, I guess I better repeat that. You went on the university committee in 1971, which was the year Serena Ponderman became head of the affirmative action.
Well, the reason I say in some ways I was very conscious, in some ways I wasn't, was because that was also the year of the merger bill in the state legislature. And so unless there were problems that could not be handled within Serena's office or in the chancellor's office, or for some reason had to come to the university committee, as this one case I was mentioning did have to come to the university committee, except in those cases, which were pretty rare as a whole, we were conscious. I mean, we were advised regularly of the general state of things, but we didn't usually enter into individual cases, so except for that sort of thing, there were so many other issues that we were faced with that, and we certainly, as a university committee, we were certainly not looking over the shoulder at everything that was being done here. On the other hand, one necessarily knew that the university was attempting to take certain kinds of actions. And there were departments, I understood, where salaries were out of line very considerably. And there was an effort made to bring those salaries into line. And that was done on at least two occasions in the 70s. Now, the fact that my salary is never one of the ones that was brought into line, I suppose, simply tells you that I'd had a different experience, a different treatment here.
I happened to be discussing this with Keith Simon. He must have been on your years.
No, he wasn't on the committee when I was. I can't remember.
He preceded you then.
Yes, I think that's right. I think he preceded me. I may have even, you serve 3 years and then there's a new, and then you go off. And it may even been that I was one of the ones, two people come on and two people go off. And he may have gone off just before I did. I'm not certain.
He mentioned that the university committee had initiated the, for women. Oh, nepotism. And I'm just wondering, but you wouldn't know about that because it must have preceded.
Well, of course, that nepotism rule is partly what I was referring to before. And the nepotism rule is a very touchy one. It had been carried to extremes here at the university at times, and it didn't just affect women or wives. I know a case where a son was not hired in a totally different department because his father was on the faculty. In fact, it wouldn't have been even in the same college. And recently we had a father and a son and a daughter on this faculty. Now that's the sort of thing that would not have happened probably as late as the 50s and maybe even into the 60s. It would not have happened. So that the rule, which probably was put into effect without any regard to women. My guess is the old rule had nothing to do with them. There probably weren't that many women seeking positions on the faculty. But, of course, it was applied to women subsequently. But it was an old one that had been there for years and years and years.
The issue was whether it was the university committee that, I think it must have been 1969 or 70, that it was actually gotten rid of. Whether it was the university committee or the chancellor's office.
I can't tell you. And the reason, those things so often get into a discussion between the chancellor and the university committee until it might be hard to be sure who initiated. And then it would be the university committee who would bring in the change of rule. They would be the ones who would bring it into the faculty senate. It could have been equally a concern of the chancellor, but I don't know. Not something I had anything to do with.
But all right, then you, if not as university committee, as faculty member, do you remember the very great push that was made to have affirmative action in hiring in the department, in the, 73, 74. And what was your view of this?
Well, actually, of course, some of that affirmative action went back before that, and certainly included blacks as much or more than women.
And I'm talking about women. I guess it's because...
it's hard to separate, because the affirmative action was always intended
to... It should have been, shouldn't it?
Yes.
It really tends not to be women.
Well, our minority hiring practices were certainly as vulnerable as our affirmative action in terms of women. And in both cases, as I said earlier about women, there's a circle here in which if there are no opportunities, you don't try. And clearly there are many more blacks coming through for degrees today, so you've got more blacks to choose from, so you can get caliber there as well as you can in men or as well as you can in women, in a sense that was not so possible in the past. Now, we did hire, of course, we hired a very competent black political science scientist about 68, and we're very, very pleased. And there, again, I don't think there was any question when we hired him, he was outstanding as a political scientist. And when it came to, by the 73, 74, I think we already had hired two or three women by that point. I'm a little vague as to when we hired whom at what point, but we would have had, Barbara Hinckley would have been here by then, and we did hire a succession of women, a couple of whom left, both cases left without any tenure decision here, and we hired a number. What do I think about affirmative action? Well, my view is that you ought to be looking for quality for the kinds of areas of your discipline that you need. I do not argue that something in the way of affirmative action, no doubt, was desirable. At least it made people much more conscious of the necessity not just to look quite as they perhaps had looked before. Again, I would say I don't think this was significant in our department, but I do think it was probably valuable in some other departments, that as the pressure grew both to hire minorities and to hire women, there was a tendency to look harder than they had looked before. Mm-hmm. I think that was true. Every one of the women we hired came from one of the major institutions from which we normally hired. Mm-hmm. It was not a change. We didn't start looking at inferior PhD granting institutions, and which still might produce an extraordinarily competent people.
We were supposed to do that according to these.
Well, we may have looked at, but we didn't need to.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't need to, because Harvard and Yale and Chicago and the Big Ten were giving degrees to top-notch women. We didn't have to look otherwise. I don't say we advertised as we were supposed to advertise, and we got the applications, but again, I'm sure that we tended to still to come out in the same, pretty much in the same ways we always said. We hired from Stanford. One of the women we got, I know, was from Stanford. One was from Cornell. One was from Harvard and Columbia and so forth. You know, this is the sort of thing we were doing. And but you see, by that time, your circle had begun to grow, because partly there were simply more women going to graduate school. Partly the fact of more women going to graduate school was a change in the general cultural attitude toward women in professions in general, and the idea either that a career was the thing to have or a career and marriage could be combined, and therefore this had happened, so your number of candidates, women candidates, had simply increased enormously in between the time I came here in the 50s and by the 70s. It's just been a totally different approach to it. And in fact, as a graduate student here at Wisconsin, before I went to Minnesota, there were two or three women out of, I don't think, maybe there were, might have been five, but I out of 100 men as graduate students here. I remember that quite vividly. Mm-hmm. Well, and by the 70s, we were getting about even numbers of men and women. So this in itself completely changed the picture. And I'm sure it was true in other disciplines as well as in political science. But your numbers had simply shifted. But I think that there were departments where it was probably a good idea to put that extra pressure on them to look more carefully at women candidates. I think it's conceivable that some departments, without even thinking about it, and perhaps not following the line of that letter I quoted to you at the beginning, but nevertheless, that type of thing, just didn't really seriously consider a woman applicant. They didn't look at her record as carefully. I'm sure that happened in some departments. I would not want to suggest it didn't happen.
So you think, or did you think about it, that Serena Ponder did an effective job
Well, I would be hard put to it to evaluate her job as her job. That the job itself, just how well she did as a person, I wouldn't want to try to evaluate. But that that there was some almost necessity establishing that kind of position and putting some pressure on departments to act in this regard, I think was there.
She's talked a good deal about the change in the university's personnel policy generally. Apparently there was none in effect until the early 70s. That is, it wasn't possible to find records in which one knew what people were being paid, when they'd been hired, when they were promoted, that sort of thing. Well, this is both academic faculty specialists.
Well, now, forgetting the academic staff, and I don't totally know the situation on the academic staff side. On the faculty side, that's not true. You could always find it. Now, that you didn't, after all, a list went up every single year to the regents listing all the faculty and their salaries and the salary recommendations. This list went up every single year, going back for 50 years. I think it was true that one of the things that happened, the university grew very, very fast between the early 60s and the following 10 years. Yes. It just grew very fast. And I am sure that many kinds of data and information that one might quite reasonably want to know about faculty salaries, how long people had been here, and a number of things like that were available, but they just weren't brought together anywhere. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that was true. And I'm sure that, I think we still lack some records here that we ought to have. I know that sometimes information about faculty meetings go out to people who aren't faculty members. We still don't. What has always scared me to death is that if we ever got collective bargaining, we'd really have problems identifying who really are the faculty members who could vote on something like that. Now, that scared me for 10 years, and I've talked about this to people. Mm-hmm. But I know it still continues. I know that in the medical school that they have people who are in, I don't know exactly the technical thing, but they're not really faculty members, but they have a relationship with the medical school, and that these people get notices of our faculty meetings when they really haven't any reason to get them. It isn't that I give a darn whether they get the notices. Mm-hmm. It's just it illustrates the issue. Mm-hmm. And we still have some problems along that line. So that for her to say there weren't good records, I'm sure she was right. There weren't good records. Mm-hmm. There still are some incomplete records. But partly, I think one does have to associate this with the enormous growth that took place in the 10 years. I'm sure our department, as many other departments, I'm sure our department doubled in that length of time. And this was happening all over the university. Well, it's almost a miracle if you keep, if you really develop a record system and change it fast enough to take care of this difference.
I guess part of the affirmative action program entailed the approval of even faculty appointments in the chancellor's office. That is, Serena Ponham, as head of the personnel, was approving them, and this was in terms of whether there had been adequate search for women appointees. And I imagine one of the complaints was that this was taking some power out of the faculty.
Yes. Now, I don't know how many times there was any veto on that. I don't know of any absolute veto on this, on an appointment as a result of that kind of review. I'm sure that a department who, if any department got a veto at that point, I'm sure they would have been pretty furious about it, because this does take it away both from the department and from the dean, now, of course, the chancellor always technically has the last word before it goes to the regents. But if I know Ed Young as I think I know him, I doubt that he very often exercised an actual veto. There might have been occasions when there was a discussion with a department chairman, but I doubt that the actual veto really occurred. I could be wrong. Mm. I don't know at all. I know Ed Young, and he finds actual vetoes on many administrative matters difficult. And in a case such as this, where you were actually dealing with a departmental and a dean's decision, I would think that would have been peculiarly difficult for him to carry through. On the other hand, that there was a kind of threat of this, that there might have been some carrying on of discussions. Well, that's part of the kind of pressure you tend to do when you're trying to achieve university-wide a policy that goes against the practice of some departments. And mm-hmm. so, although I doubt the actual veto, there may have been some kind of a threat of this, a review, and so forth. I don't know.
Okay. The secretary of the faculty was Charles Loomer was in, or Bill Loomer was in the office at the time. I guess their function was somewhat taken over by the chancellor's office. Were you in on, did you have any?
No, we didn't have much to see. Bill Loomer had he just been chairman of the university committee, or had been chairman
had
3 years before or something? That again goes back to the whole issue of how your records are kept.
Yes.
And I believe that the records did need improving. And as I say, I'm not even sure that today we still got them in fully good shape. And if I were to comment on Bill, he always has had a tendency to take life as easy as he can. And I'm not saying this critically, but Bill's not the kind to enter into a big fight unless he, or to be greatly innovative in this kind of thing. I suspect he took on the secretaryship of the faculty with the assumption that he could just carry on from Alden White. And he was not about to make big changes. And of course, as you need new information for different purposes than you've used it in the press, then you begin to need information that hadn't existed. Mm-hmm. And so there inevitably there was going to be some conflict, I assume, there. This is one of the things I try to teach people in administration, that what kinds of statistics you have may determine a policy, and if you want a different policy, you may have to make a big thing out of getting different statistics. And this is, we often overlook this, but just the kind of data that's brought together. At one point, we had almost no Bureau of the Census data on county government. We had it on cities, occasionally on villages and states, but very little on counties. Well, the County Governments Association really lobbied to get special information and the census data on counties. Mm-hmm. And this put the county in a totally different light and with a totally different kind of opportunity for influence than it had before. The same thing holds true here. And as long as the university was smaller, there were always people who knew these things. I mean, they knew how many women, they knew whether there were salary problems, they knew this. They may or may not have paid much attention to it, but they likely knew it. But when you had this tremendous increase in the faculty in the 60s and into the 70s, nobody really knew.
Anyway, we're now starting on the second session of the interview. This is July 8th, and we're going to talk about the merger and your work on the Merger Implementation Committee. And I wondered if you would say first what had been your views during the 60s of what was going on in the reorganization of the university.
I think that during the 60s, when Mr. Harrington was president, there were so many changes going on that most people, and that in large part included me, really were quite unaware of the extent of change in the system and the really different kind of university structure that we had by 1970-71 as against the period of 10 years before that. Before that, for a long time, or of course before there was Milwaukee or Green Bay or Parkside, the university had been a single institution with a president at the head of it, and the president always saw himself as the president of the Madison institution, and the center system and extension were simply particular parts of the Madison institution with their own deans. What happened in the 60s, and for a period this continued, even after Milwaukee became a part of it. President was, in a sense, the president of Madison in a special way, but also the administering officer for the other units of the what was becoming a system. And my dates here, I don't recall them exactly, but somewhere in the middle 60s or so, Mr. Harrington made the point of developing, in a much more formal sense, a separate system, a system that included the whole set of institutions.
Yes.
And this system then became Green Bay, Parkside, Milwaukee, Madison, Extension, and the Center system.
Now, what I want is your own. You say you're generally not conscious of it. You're so busy, all of you, thinking about things going on here.
So I don't pretend that I know much about this, except that when we came into the 70s, where the problem lay was that when we came into the 70s and the governor proposed and succeeded in getting across the merger bill, which now added the WSU institutions along with these other institutions that had taken on a separate identity within the University of Wisconsin, so that Madison in one sense was simply one of the institutions within a number of institutions. And one of the issues that then became much clearer than it had been for, or became much more, most people became more conscious of, was that certain steps had been taken in the 70s, which laid possible precedents for the new and much enlarged system that were detrimental to Madison.
Yes.
And this had to do with the way in which funding had been done, the way in which certain bequests that had been made to Madison had in fact then been shared with Milwaukee and I believe Green Bay at one point. And it was these kinds of issues that again became extraordinarily important when we were talking about organizing and structuring the system that resulted from the bringing in of the WSU institutions. Yeah. And it was in this regard that the university committee and, especially the university committee, worked very hard in getting certain provisions into the merger bill that would help to assure that Madison's resources would not be available for general distribution to all institutions in the system. We were largely successful in this, so there were some problems.
The reason I'm interrupting you is that I want you to, I mean, this is in your chapter, so.
Yeah.
Who do you think, do you remember how this first, I know Ed Young mentioned it as something he feels that he was perhaps responsible for noticing, and Dave Cronin has also talked about it. Do you have a sense of how this realization came about? Incidentally, what was this meeting that the university committee had with Harry? Oh, you weren't there.
No, that was just I think those minutes are over
that's
there.
That's what I want to find.
That was a meeting that the university committee had with Mr. Harrington just after he resigned. And this was the famous meeting in which Mr. Harrington said that if he'd been on the university committee, he would have been a lot tougher on him as president
than
the university committee had in fact been on him. And they would have been made many more inquiries into what he was doing. It was one of these fascinating bits of fascinating statements that one is really interested in, but it was clear, and to an extent one's seen this all the way through. It depends on what position you hold. There's a there's a famous story in public administration about where you sit is what you see. I'm not saying it very well, but everything depends on your point of view in the responsibility that you hold. And Mr. Harrington, as president, saw needs which he tried to take care of for the several units in the system before merger, which were not necessarily in the interests of Madison. Mm. And so when he made his statement, he was saying, in effect, Madison has not been looking after its own interests as well as they probably should have. And whoever is president here, Madison ought to make more certain that it is seeing to its interests vis-a-vis the individual who is president, whose responsibilities are different than the responsibilities of the Madison Institution, the chancellor, the university committee representing the faculty, and so on.
So it was really the chancellor and the university committee that, in fact, really should have been
Yeah, and I think one of the problems was, which it's always hard to learn, is that many people assumed, since Harrington had come out of the faculty here, had been president of the Madison campus, that he obviously understood and would look after Madison's interests in the office of president. Mm. And this is, again, the kind of an assumption that people too often make, and they fail to recognize that in a different position, the person, no matter what ties he may have with a part of that system, has to take on different responsibilities when he holds a when he takes takes on the presidency, the whole thing, and must in effect recognize other interests.
Did you have anything to do with Bob Clodius during this period yourself?
Oh, very incidentally. I wouldn't consider. I knew Bob Clodius fairly well. I would see him from time to time, but I don't think I had enough to do there that I would have any comment. It would be hard for me to distinguish anything I knew about what Bob Clodius was doing there from what I knew myself and what I sort of picked up as a sort of the general gossip, if you will. It was perhaps more than gossip, but you know, it was that sort of thing that I knew there.
Hmm. Well, all right. You said how? Incidentally, were you a supporter of Lucy when he ran for governor?
Yes, I did support Lucy for governor. Yes. I never have been. I probably signed a statement that may have appeared in the newspapers. I may have given him a little money in his campaign. I voted for him. That's about as much as I've ever done in a gubernatorial campaign, and I haven't done even that at times.
And what was your...
I may have given him a little money in his campaign. I voted for him. That's about as much as I've ever done in a gubernatorial campaign, and I haven't done even that at times.
And what was your view of merger when he proposed it?
I was opposed to merger.
Completely?
Yes. Now, as I say in that article or that chapter in the Bogue Taylor book, I found myself seeing issues as I really tried to write the chapter and look back on a greater in greater depth on the history of the institutions of higher education in Wisconsin.
You don't have to repeat the... all right, tell me about your appointment to the Merger Implementation Committee.
Well, I was, by the time the merger bill went through, of course, I'd been on the university committee for a few weeks, I guess it was probably a few months, and had participated in some of the meetings of the university committee with some of the legislative leaders down there to attempt to get the best provisions possible from the point of view of merger. And if we...
Was this at your... Whose instigation was this, that the university committee should go down and talk to legislators? Do you remember?
As far as I know, this was instigated by the university committee itself.
The whole... Everybody on it, I mean, or one...
Yes.
Did somebody spearhead the alarm?
I don't know that anybody individually, you have to recognize that I had just come on the university committee, therefore the other four of the people out of the six had been dealing with the idea and the possibility and the probability of merger for several months by the time I came onto the committee, and therefore they were aware of issues in a more detailed sense probably than I was, and I would be confident that they had talked with the chancellor and probably with others here at the university. And but I think that as near as I could tell from the time I went on, the committee itself was reading every possible bill or any possible or suggested change in the bill, and was concerned, and that the committee's view was, one, that we were against merger, two, if merger was inevitable, then we wanted to get the very best possible terms we could get. And it was in this context that we talked to the leadership in both the Assembly and the Senate, especially in the Assembly, and that we attempted to talk with other people in terms of the provisions that were being suggested.
Did you go together?
Yes.
All of you?
Yes.
The whole committee?
I remember vividly that one time we had a luncheon in Norm Anderson's office. If you will recall, I believe Norm Anderson was Speaker of the Assembly at that time. Mm-hmm. And we had a meeting in Norm Anderson's office, and Norm was there, and Tony Earle, who was at that time Majority Leader, I believe that was his position, and I think they were the people we worked with that particular noon. But we had a sandwich, everybody brought a sandwich, and we sat around a big table and talked about issues, and I recall that Norm and Tony said to us, look, the bill's going through. There's just no question it's going through. Mm-hmm. So the thing that you can do, and we see what we can do to help on it, is to get those provisions in the bill that will be valuable to Madison. And so it was in that connection that we were especially anxious to get into the original bill. And this was the bill that was in the budget, if you will recall, mm-hmm. in 71. And it had nothing to do with the Merger Implementation Study Committee, because that was in there, but that was separate.
Yeah.
The bill itself really provided generally for merger, and made certain kinds of conditions, and one of them had to do with the idea that each institution, it wasn't, of course they didn't just write it in Madison, but each institution would retain its own resources that represented bequests and the like, mm-hmm. and that these were not something that would be shared or moved around in the system.
I'd just like to ask you about the committee at that time. Which were the most effective members? Do you remember, I mean, how you must have sort of rated them as you got?
I suppose the people that I thought were, Ray Bowen was chairman, and I thought was very effective. Hector DeLuca contributed, partly because his father-in-law was Senator Swan from Rock County, I believe it was Rock County, and Senator Swan was a very conservative Republican.
I'm in, Clara, when you're done.
Senator Swan was a very conservative Republican who could help us on occasion. He didn't always agree with us, but at least this was an in that we did have since he was Hector's father-in-law. And Dave Cronin, I would say that they were the most effective on the committee, but other...
Stedman and
Wilson Thede. Wilson Thede was on the committee, and Who was the other man?
Stedman, was he?
Stedman, John Stedman, yes. Mm-hmm. John had been elected with me, so that John and I were new to the committee. And Wilson made contributions, but I think the other three, especially Ray Bowen and Dave Cronin, probably made the most contributions. Dave had a number of contacts in the legislature as a result of his work through the Historical Society. So all of these were important in what we were trying to do.
You know, I'm curious. I don't know. Maybe you can't answer this, but have you had a feeling that your training as a political scientist gives you a different outlook on some of these events than, let's say, a scientist, or is it not particularly relevant to how good you are as an administrator?
I think there are two things there. One, because public administration has been my specialty, I think in terms of how good I am as an administrator, I think that it does have something to do with it. I don't say other people can't be, but I think it has something to do with it. And I think it's always had something to do with my willingness to see an administrator's point of view in a situation, and therefore to be more tolerant of administrators than some people are. And in the slightly broader context, my sense of politics and the role of legislators probably made me more sympathetic to some of the things that they were involved with than it might make many other people.
Did you notice this on the committee when you went to talk to legislators? Were you aware of having a greater sense of the things they were coping with, the legislators?
Well, it's hard for me to reconstruct that with certainty. I think it would be certainly true that I took a fairly active role from the beginning, a more active role than Mr. Stedman did, who, though a lawyer, I had very little experience with politics. And I think that over the time that I was on the university committee, this sense of politics probably had some significance for me.
Okay, well, go on with it. You're leading up to your...
We worked hard to get certain provisions in the bill, and as a matter of fact, we got, if we had to have merger, we got probably about as good a bill as we could have gotten in interest to Madison. Then, of course, the problem became who was going to be appointed to the Merger Implementation Study Committee.
I want to ask you, before you get on, was Ed Young also down there?
Not with us.
Do you know whether I should talk to him about this, I guess.
No, I think that what you would find is, I'm sure that the Chancellor did deal with the legislators and certain individuals and the governor, for that matter, on these issues, but he acted independently and we acted independently. Mm-hmm. There were at times exchange of information. These were not things that were done totally in isolation. Yeah. So that we certainly were aware that he was talking to people, as he knew we were talking to people. This was a situation in which there was almost no disagreement. I can't even think of any disagreement between the university and the chancellor on the issues that were involved. Hence, exchanging information was simple, but there was just an assumption that we would be more effective by our operating independently, and this is in fact what we did.
Okay.
And I don't know whether anybody has told you, even before any of this that I've just been discussing, after the governor's merger bill was sent up to the legislature, there was a meeting with the governor of about 15 or 20 faculty leaders.
I think I saw that he came for a half an hour.
No, no.
Or is that a different?
I think you're talking about something different. He talked to the University Senate here.
Okay, that's
in the summer.
Yes.
That was in the summer of 71. Right. But when I'm discussing something that goes back to February, I think, and I couldn't repeat to you who all was there. I simply have forgotten. I know Hank Lardy was there. I know Bob Ozan was there. Jack Barbash, Dave Feldman. I was there. But I'm vague about just who all else. But I know that it amounted to 50 or 20 faculty members representing a wide spectrum of disciplines and colleges within the Madison campus. I think only Madison faculty were there. And there was a general discussion with the governor. I'm not sure that we achieved anything, but at least there was an exchange of views relative to merger. Mm-hmm. And then there
Who do you know who organized that?
I think Bob Ozan did, but I'm not absolutely certain of that. But I think it was Bob Ozan who organized that. And there was simply, as I say, a broad discussion. And I remember that one of the things that was said was that Governor Lucy said there was a great deal of dissatisfaction with the university, and especially Madison, in the legislature. And of course this was in part due to all the difficulties that the Madison campus had in the early or late 60s and early 70s in connection with Vietnam. And I remember that I reminded the governor that he and I were both from southwestern Wisconsin, he originally from Prairie du Chien and I from Lancaster, and that he probably would recall when a man by the name of Chapel from Ashland, I believe, Ashland or Superior, but I think it's Ashland, campaigned for the U.S. senatorship and for some other positions in politics here by attacking the university, and he had never won anything by doing that, and in fact that it had been the normal role of governors to support the university and to defend it against its critics, so that whatever criticism and unhappiness did exist within the legislature, that it seemed to me the governor might take a role in this. He recalled the incident that I referred to, but of course he saw himself in his view of protecting Madison by the merger. This was part of the argument that he made at that time, and so this was part of what went on in that at that particular incident. And then
it wasn't a very satisfactory
meeting. No, it wasn't a terribly satisfactory meeting. It was probably all right. I don't think it did it. I'd be certain it didn't do any damage. Whether it did any, helped any, I'm not at all certain that it did. And then in July, I believe it was July, when the merger bill was going through, I think the governor asked to come out and talk to the faculty senate. I'm not exactly certain how the invitation came about, whether we invited him or he asked to. I know that there was a second meeting a year later in which the governor did call out, or one of the people in the governor's office called out and asked to have a meeting with the faculty, and this took place, I now forget the date, but I know it could be checked out. It must have been in 72, or it certainly would have been 72,
be I think.
Yeah. Yes, I'm sure there was. In any event, that was all the background here.
Yeah.
Now, when they set up a merger implementation study committee as a part of the attempt to get the final version of the merger bill, the committee was quite a large committee, And it included one representative from the Madison faculty. Oh, no, excuse me. It included one representative from the UW system and one representative, one faculty representative from the former WSU system, a student from the UW system as it had been, and a student from the old WSU system. Now, I think that there was very little argument in terms of the WSU system. The man who was then president of TOF became the WSU faculty representative, and there was a student who had been kind of the student leader of the WSU grouping, who almost automatically became the student representative. He also had been a strong supporter of Mr. Lucy, as had the WSU people. On the UW side, this was a very much more complicated matter. And initially, the University committee, it wasn't the university committee, I can't think of the name that it represented, and was a grouping of all the university committees of the UW system. So
the
that
faculty
we used
council,
faculty council. Mm-hmm. The faculty council initially suggested Ray Bowen, nominated Ray Bowen to the governor, and the governor made it clear that he would not accept Mr. Bowen as the nominee. This was at a time when Mr. Reagan was governor of California, and Mr. Bowen, at a meeting in which a member of Mr. Lucy's group had been there, had made the remark that Mr. Lucy was doing about as well for the university here as Mr. Reagan was doing in California. And Mr. Lucy didn't like this comparison. This is among the problems that existed. And so he made it clear he wouldn't accept it. So then, of course, the issue became who could be, whom the faculty council could nominate. And there was a real question whether it might be a faculty member from Milwaukee. Naturally, Madison wanted to have a faculty member. And this is off the record, isn't it? I mean, it's nobody's going to. In a very private Sunday morning brunch meeting, after Ed Young had told us that under no circumstances would the governor accept Mr. Bowen, Ray Bowen and Dave Cronin and I had coffee at my house, and there was an agreement that I would accept the nomination from the faculty council. So at the very next meeting of the faculty council, Dave Cronin nominated me for this. Now, since I was brand new, this was a little unusual, but anyway, they did nominate me for it, and it was approved by the faculty council. So then the nomination went to the governor.
Was there any question of Dave Cronin's wanting to do it, do you think? Was it a plum or was it a chore?
Well, it was a chore. And don't ask me why they decided that probably politically I was in better shape to take it than Dave Cronin was. But that was the presumption that was made in this meeting. There was another, I think it may have had to do with another situation, in that there was only one other woman in the faculty council, and they didn't feel she was strong enough. She was from the center system, I believe, and they didn't think she was strong enough to handle it. And I think maybe they thought that making an appointment of suggesting a nomination of a woman would not only appeal to the council, but would appeal to the governor, because I was the only woman on it. Yes,
yeah.
And I think there were these kinds of considerations here that I was probably personally acceptable to the governor. It would give him a woman appointment and so forth. in any event, that was the inside deal that was made as far as I know it.
How did you feel about it? I mean, it was an exceedingly important commission, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was. It was very important. This was a nomination or a proposal. It wasn't the governor's appointment. But then there was a lot of maneuvering as to whether or not the governor would go along on this. And there were some connections and some pressures or some influence attempted. In any event.
On him.
On him. Mm-hmm. In any event, I remember that I was called and asked by him if I would accept it if he did in fact appoint me, and I said yes. And then there was some in-between period, and I know that Esther Kaplan for one person and if curiously Dave Carley for another, I know both of them supported me with the governor. Mm-hmm. And I know I got a telephone call on a Monday morning from Esther telling me that she was sure it was going through that day. Mm-hmm. And then there was a university committee meeting at which I told them what I knew. And then that afternoon there was a faculty senate meeting, and in the middle of the faculty senate meeting I was called out for a telephone call from the governor saying that he was appointing me. And I went back and told the university committee members that it had happened. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as what went on afterwards, now that was in the early spring, I believe, of 72. I sort of lose my dates exactly, but it was sometime in the early spring. And then we started meeting, and there was a lot of perhaps kind of the usual problems when the big committee met as to what we really were going to do, what was the intent, and there was a lot of sort of spinning of wheels there for a period. And then Jack Pelasek was named chairman of a presumably ad hoc committee that was going to rewrite the statute.
Yeah. Now that kind of detail is in your chapter.
Okay.
I'm curious about the people, how they behaved, what the lineups were in terms of what they wanted. And Solberg was the chairman, Weaver the secretary. Did Weaver really play any role in it?
Basically, Solberg and Weaver and some of the others, I would have said, played almost no role. Mm-hmm. I don't want to suggest that they had nothing here that I did, but they never, I'm sure they would have attempted to veto anything that they actively opposed.
Yeah.
But I think there was not enough in the, as things developed, to make them take a major role.
Now, are you just being polite now?
That's my memory of it. No, I'm not just being polite. Right. I just don't think my memory is they just didn't take an active role.
I'm just wondering if it was because they didn't weren't strong enough, didn't have strong enough opinions. I don't know them, or have some views.
Well, you see, initially there was a lot of discussion about whether the committee should try to write a paper on sort of the philosophy of higher education in Wisconsin, and whether you would do this and whether you would do that and so forth and so on. And then in the long run, and certainly Jack Pelasek was by far the strongest voice in many respects in that committee, did the most work and all. Jack was the one who simply, and perhaps because he was a lawyer, his whole view was, we rewrite the statute, period. We don't try to do all kinds of other things. There isn't any way to do it. We couldn't ever get anywhere with it. We'll rewrite the statute, and that's it. And that is, of course, in fact, what they did. And then, but if you, I don't remember how I wrote in the chapter. The fact is, I was not, there was no faculty member, neither I nor the WSU representative was originally appointed to that ad hoc committee that did the real rewriting. And we heard, as we were bound to hear, that there were some, that, you know, they were just sort of going ahead glibly without knowing a good many things that we felt they ought to know. And so there was going to be a meeting one day, and I called up Mr. Pelasek and said, Jack, I'm going to come to the next meeting just to, you know, I could come as a part of the public. I was entitled to do that. So I said I was going to be there at the next meeting of the committee. And he said, is Ray Bone coming? I said, yes. He said, is Dave Cronin coming? I said, yes. And I said, also the WSU faculty member is coming. And he said, be full house. And so we went down to the meeting, and he just included me and the WSU faculty member on, around the table that the committee was sitting at. And
I'm wondering why you weren't put on the committee to begin with. That seems to me preposterous.
Well, you see, I just don't think, Mr. Solberg had been on the Board of Regents, I believe, of the WSU system.
Yes.
And I think that he wasn't very, knowledgeable or very, just wasn't conscious, didn't think in terms of having faculty members on this kind of a committee. Maybe his view of the role of the committee. I think it was less deliberate in the sense of just keeping us off than it was non-thinking about it. His sensitivity to this sort of thing simply wasn't there.
Weren't there people on the committee who, including yourself, who could have protested?
Well, we didn't do anything about it at the time. I guess at that time we weren't either totally clear as to how the thing was going to progress. In fact, from the time I went to that first meeting,
yeah,
Jack Pelasek acted as if I and the WSU faculty member were in fact part of the committee. And when the committee report was signed, he included us as members of the committee. Now, all of that was done on his own initiative and never with a formal appointment from Mr. Solberg.
So he was capable of independent action, obviously.
That's right. And he was, that's why I keep saying, he was a strong man on the committee. Now, I would also say something else that I don't think I wrote. He operated a very interesting kind of committee situation.
You did say he gave everybody a chance.
Everybody had a chance to say whatever they wanted to say, and he just let everybody talk. And whether they were people who weren't on the committee, people who had interests of this kind or that kind, as we, in effect, sort of went down the statute and talked about areas of the statute. And we were permitted to, everybody was permitted to sort of talk as they wanted to. And then, after several months of this, he then began to tie the thing together in a very tight and careful way. And I was tremendously impressed with his ability to handle this kind of disparate situation and yet get something that really really went together in the end. What were we interested on in the statute? Well, what they did was to take the old statute governing Madison,
chapter 36,
and simply went down the language of that chapter to try to make it make sense for the WSU system as well as the UW system. And the fact was, as we went over it, that there were a number of things in it that no longer made sense for the UW system, even quite apart from merger itself.